I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, you'll hear the first of a two-part conversation with activist and journalist Pierce Redmond of Porkin's Policy Review and the Open Minds Foundation on the topic of disgraced billionaire and convicted child sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein has come up in two of my previous episodes, both featuring private investigator Ed Opperman. The scandalous life and times of Jeffrey Epstein have become a source for many a right-wing conspiracy theory due to Epstein's connections with Bill Clinton. And yet right-wing pundits have been noticeably quiet on Epstein's relationship with current President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. And they've been even more mum's the word when it comes to the recent secretive and low-key meeting between Epstein and former Trump White House official and all-around right-wing man of infamy, Steve Bannon. Pierce Redmond joins me in this two-parter to unpack the whole sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein. I want to get straight to the meat of the Epstein case, so I'm going to skip the musical transitions this time and get right into the conversation with Pierce Redmond. Welcome to Parallax Views, Pierce Redmond of Porkin's Policy.
Hello, JJ. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm very excited to be speaking with you.
Yeah, and I wanted to have you on because you do a lot of reporting and research with Porkin's Policy, and one of the areas of interest you have is a topic I've been covering with private investigator Ed Opperman, and that's this whole case of Jeffrey Epstein. And for my listeners who haven't maybe heard the Opperman podcast or had trouble connecting all the dots at once, how would you sum up this sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein? Who is this guy?
Well, I guess to give the listeners just a quick kind of like soundbite, he is a, I would say first and foremost, he is a convicted pedophile who may or may not be worth around $1 billion. We can debate that. I'm sure we'll get into it a little bit later on in the show. But I would say he's a convicted pedophile who did manage the money for some very rich and powerful people over the years, including the heir to the Limited Two fortune and some other interesting people, some very interesting wealthy Spanish woman as well, who there's a whole story with that. But he managed money for some of these people. He sort of was able to integrate himself into some very rich people's lives, and would supposedly help them manage money, help them invest, do things like that. He for a time fancied himself as some sort of like a hedge fund person, but basically he's a very rich individual who uses his own wealth as a means, I think, to facilitate his sexual trafficking enterprise, which consists of Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, and then a few other characters, Leslie Groff, Sarah Kellen or Sarah Kensington. Natalia Malyashev is another person. There's a whole list of these individuals, but basically I would say he uses his wealth, as a way to get close to other wealthy people, and celebrities and politicians and whatnot. But essentially he, uses all these things as a means to facilitate his, disgusting sexual appetites, which, mainly consist of abusing, girls between the ages of 15 to 17, sometimes a little bit younger, if some of the rumors are to be believed. But yeah, that's one way of summing up who this person is. And of course, he's very close friends probably over 20 years with Donald Trump. He's of course famous, I think maybe a little bit too famous for his trips with Bill Clinton, which I think is a factor in this saga, but not the main one. I think the main one really is Donald Trump, and many, many other people. Like I said, celebrities, journalists, politicians, world leaders, certainly a lot of people in finance. I mean, he got his start working for Bear Stearns until he got in trouble with the SEC, which we can talk about as well, because that's a very bizarre story. And he never really actually, did any time for that. But, he's described many times as the billionaire pedophile, who is connected to virtually everybody. And to an extent that is absolutely true. So that's sort of how I would describe him. And of course he, famously, went to, jail. He was convicted, in the mid 2000s, and he spent a fraction of his time. I think he was sentenced to 13 months, but he only served something like 10 or 11 months in a private wing of a prison that he had actually donated a significant amount of money to in the past. So he was alone, and he was also on a work release program, so he was free to go Monday through Friday. During the day he would return to his large house in Palm Beach, just right down the road, essentially, from Mar-a-Lago, and he was there abusing children, and then he would return to the prison at night, and he was required to stay there during the weekend. And there are even rumors that he flew out of the country, or at least down to the Caribbean, to his island in the U.S. Virgin Islands. It's rumored that he even did that a few times and then would fly back. So, that was, of course, a big deal. This guy who was, abusing, by some estimates, entire schools of children, essentially. He received this basically a slap on the wrist. He is registered as a he is to register as a sex offender for the rest of his life, thank God. But, when he returned, he threw a very lavish party here in New York, at his, probably the most expensive townhouse in the city, on East 71st Street. He threw a very lavish party, which was filled with journalists, politicians, celebrities, all of these people that suddenly now are just, shocked and mortified, or they never heard of the guy. Well, they were all at his house for a big party, and he famously remarked that, his crime wasn't really all that serious, and that it was the equivalent of him stealing a bagel, is what he told the New York Post. And we should just note that he pled guilty to solicitation of underage prostitution, which is a bogus term or legal loophole, because if an underage child cannot consent to sex, they certainly cannot consent to get paid to have sex. But that is the charge. That is what Epstein went with. And he really only, copped to a few of these. He only admitted to paying, I think it was just a handful of young girls at the time. So that's sort of the Jeffrey Epstein in a nutshell. Of course, there are many, many rabbit holes that we can go down. There's lots of avenues. As I've researched the Epstein saga, you see that his connections to so many people, it just sort of grows and grows. We were just talking off air, but I was mentioning Roger Stone. There is a bizarre connection with Roger Stone and the Epstein case. If you go through Epstein's little black book, which we really kind of only know in part because of Alfredo Rodriguez, who was his body man, I guess, his butler, essentially, who was in the house, he tried to sell it at one point, but the little black book eventually became public. There's tons and tons of names in there, a lot for Donald Trump, including his children and his chief of security, lots of numbers for Bill Clinton, but also lots of other people. Courtney Love famously appears in the little black book, which we can talk about if you want to. Lots of very rich people in New York. Lots of old money in New York. I don't know if you've ever seen the film The Jinx about Robert Durst.
Yeah.
So his I think that was Eugene Jarecki. Jarecki's father is, Eugene and Andrew Jarecki, and I think there's a third brother as well. They actually grew up as fabulously wealthy in New York City, which is partly why I think Jarecki chose to profile and to talk about Durst, because he grew up very much in that same world, that very erudite, old money in New York. And his parents are fabulously wealthy. They were in Epstein's little black book. And of course, lots of other things, including a whole section of what he said were, quote, massages. So these were numbers for underage girls that would give him massages. There were even numbers of their parents were listed under the massage section, as well as international massages. He had a lot for the UK and also in Paris, where he still maintains a apartment, a residency in the center of Paris. So, there's lots that we could unpack and explore with this, but I find him interesting because everybody seems to be connected to this guy at some point in their life. And we saw with the recent presidential election, of course, we saw Hillary Clinton running and Donald Trump running, two people that were intimately connected to Jeffrey Epstein. Hillary Clinton more so because of her husband's trips down to his island and also trips to Africa that they took with Kevin Spacey and Chris Tucker. And Donald Trump even more so, because, Donald Trump goes way, way back. To the, I think at least maybe the late 80s, early 90s, with Epstein's whole entire clique as well. There are photos of Trump and Ghislaine Maxwell from the mid 90s. There are lots of pictures, not lots, but there are several pictures of Donald Trump hanging out with Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell at various times in Mar-a-Lago and also in New York City. And there are lots of documented instances where they were, they've both flown on each other's private planes at least, once that we can officially, swear in a court of law that happened. Once it was admitted to by, I think it was Mark Epstein, Jeffrey Epstein's brother, admitted that Donald Trump flew on Epstein's private plane to back to New York from Palm Beach. And there's also a documented time where Donald Trump was actually held up his plane on the tarmac in Palm Beach so that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell could get on the plane and fly with him back to New York, which says a lot about the respect that Donald Trump pays to this man. Because Donald Trump is not someone that holds – you don't make him wait. You know what I mean? And the fact that he held up his own plane on the tarmac, and he had a journalist with him at the time that was profiling him and his wife and their golf exploits for a now defunct magazine called Maximum Golf, which was at the time it was owned by the Murdoch Group. So, you know, that I think that kind of illustrates the relationship that these two men have, in spite of the fact that, you know, as Donald Trump claims to have never known him, you know, or that he kicked him out of his out of Mar-a-Lago when he found out that he was picking up young girls there. I don't really believe that for a second. This is a man, you know, who's in New York Magazine, of course, is quoted, a terrific guy, known him for 15 years. He likes the women almost as much as I do, and many of them on the younger side, so essentially admitting to it. You know, and then there's all these photos of them together. You know, I think their relationship is much more complex and much deeper than the Clinton one. And I almost feel like the Clinton side of it gets a lot of attention because obviously Bill Clinton is a sleazeball. And, you know, of course, what the hell is he doing hanging out with him on his private island? But I think that gets a little bit too much attention, particularly from the more right wing conspiracy media. Because they have such a soft spot for their, you know, savior, Donald Trump. But I think Donald Trump's connections to Epstein go way deeper, and there's a lot more going on right now, specifically with Donald Trump, his administration, and the way that they, I believe, are protecting Epstein and protecting and ensuring that no big bombshell will come out. But I'll stop talking now and I'll throw it back to you because I know I just kind of went off on a little bit of a rant there.
Well, there's a million different directions we can go in with this, but yeah, I want to like point out for people because I've talked about Epstein to people that don't always follow, you know, scandals and stuff like this. And they're like, it just sounds like a conspiracy theory or, you know, it's sort of like Robert Durst, actually. Before Eugene Jarecki did that movie about Durst, if you were to talk about Durst, people would just sort of like be confused, you know, mm-hmm. Or they would be like, what do you mean? This can't be true. But I was going to say, I think just to put a fine point on this, I think this whole case starts with a mother going to Palm Beach police and saying her 14-year-old stepdaughter was, you know, paid by Epstein to do a striptease and a massage. And then the FBI gets involved. And the FBI says there's like 40 different, you know, women that came to them saying the same stuff. Am I correct about that?
Oh, yeah, yeah, 100%. No, yeah, anytime if anyone ever tries to, I don't buy this, or I mean, the Palm Beach Police Department really doesn't do a hell of a lot. You know, there's not a ton of crime in Palm Beach. They're not known as being a crack investigative team. But when it came to this particular case, they had an airtight case. You know, they did everything by the book. They went through garbage. They interviewed dozens, if not, you know, I don't even hundreds of different witnesses. You know, all sorts of people, and they present, I mean, if you read the probable cause affidavit, which I would recommend anyone out there who's, doesn't believe this, read that, just that alone. Okay. Not even factoring in, you know, the other reports that have come out, but just the probable cause affidavit. Yeah. I mean, there's no doubting that this man was, compulsively abusing kids. I mean that's the interesting portion of this is like if you try to kind of like get down to the psychology of this man. I mean I believe he cannot control himself. He has an insatiable desire for abusing young girls. There were dozens of young girls. Like I said, I mean at his peak down in Palm Beach, and we're talking about, you know, 2004, 2005, when he was really going through sometimes two or three young girls a day were coming over to give him massages. He had this down to an art and a science, and he had an entire network where he would find, young girls who he would abuse. And then when they became just a little bit too old for him, and we're talking like 18, you know, that was like too much. Then they would start recruiting other young girls. And it was like a whole network to the point where you had literally like entire schools where you had a large segment of the female student body that was going over to this guy's house and engaging in all sorts of different sexual acts. And he always made sure to pay them, which I think is, is a way to deflect from him. And we see that a lot when people kind of talk about, oh, well, they were getting money, so they kind of wanted to be there. You know, that's very key to much of his abuse, is that, you know, he, in his own mind, he tries to make these kids complicit in what he's doing. And that's how he was ultimately able to cop this bogus solicitation of underage prostitution, because he paid all of these young girls. In some cases, I mean, he bought them cars. He would send flowers if they had like a school performance, like a, you know, a drama club, play was going on or something like that. And that's sort of what's happening, right now, here in New York. There's another case, the Jane Doe 43 case, where this, young woman, is, going after Epstein, Maxwell, Leslie Groff, Sarah Kellen, the whole cast of characters. But one of the things that she alleged is that, you know, Epstein promised to get her into FIT. She wanted to pursue fashion. He promised that he could get her in there, and he never really did. But that was another thing he did as well. You know, he would promise to put them through school. These are all manipulative tactics.
Well, I want to comment on that real quick. All these right wingers I know will bring up Bill Clinton and Lewinsky, and they'll say, "Oh, well, it's a power imbalance. That's horrible." And yet, there's people defending Epstein. I mean, that's a massive power imbalance. He's a billionaire.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, while I do think that the whole Monica Lewinsky Bill Clinton thing is actually quite abhorrent, and
I agree. Yeah,
he's a young intern. If he wasn't Bill Clinton, you know, if this was just a guy in your office, I mean, forget about it. There'd be no question. But that was, while there was a power imbalance there, ultimately, I do believe it was consensual to whereas with the Epstein side, I mean, there's no way. I mean, and like you said, the power imbalance is massive. Now, not all the time, but many times Epstein was also picking girls from, quote unquote, the other side of the tracks in Palm Beach. So he was going to lower income neighborhoods. He was going to, rougher schools. These are not like the hoity toity, very posh, kids that live. These are, regular people, essentially, So he would all, he loved to prey on kids that were financially strapped. That he certainly was paying off parents, and families. If a guy is coming with, a massive check, you're working three jobs, your wife is working two jobs, you've got car bills, you're trying to maybe put your daughter through school, that check might look really, that might be something that people are willing to take. And in fact, a lot of people did take that. So, yeah, I mean, the power dynamic is vastly, out of proportion with everything that Epstein does. So, again, when these girls are also coming, not necessarily in Palm Beach, because his house in Palm Beach is actually pretty, cheap looking. It's not a really nice one. It's very nondescript. His place in New York City is massive. I mean, it's quite impressive. I've walked past it a few times. it's meant to be inside, just absolutely outrageous. I mean, he owns a freaking island. So again, when you're bringing, when people are seeing this, yeah, obviously, I mean, there's like an awe factor that gets factored in to his way of abusing as well. So yeah, I mean, but the power dynamic is he's a billionaire and he's an adult, you know. And Epstein is also very careful. You know, it's always other women that were bringing these girls, you know. So if you read through not only some of the interviews that the Palm Beach PD did, you know, and you through the probable cause affidavit as well, they quote from some of these. But if you just also, I mean, the Jane Doe 43 and other people that have come forward, Virginia Roberts and others, you know, it was always well, but there was a woman there. You know, it was Maxwell was there, or Sarah Kellen was there, or Leslie Groff was there. These are older women. They always assumed nothing could happen, you know, like that, or that it wouldn't get out of hand. So again, you know, very, very clever predator when it comes to Epstein.
And, you know, just to really show just how much wealth this guy has, his defense lawyers included Gerald Lefcourt, who was involved with the Abbie Hoffman trial, Alan Dershowitz of O.J. Simpson fame and also a million and one other things,
mm-hmm.
and Ken Starr was also one of his defense lawyers, the guy who was involved in all the Clinton stuff. So,
oh, and Roy Black, who's a very famous Florida lawyer, he helped get one of the Kennedy family members off of, like, I think it was a rape charge. So yeah, I mean, and even his lawyers right now, the ones that he has here in New York, I mean, are just fabulously wealthy, very expensive, you know. So, but yeah, absolutely. I mean, that should. Although I will note that, you know, Forbes magazine would not consider him a billionaire because they could not confirm any of his money. They, you know, he's hidden it very well, and that is. That is something that he learned when he was a young man, sort of getting into business, was hiding money and finding money. And that's sort of how he was able to ingratiate himself with some very rich and powerful people. But he learned a lot of, you know, tricks of the trade by working at Bear Stearns and then later for Steve Hoffenberg, who was Bernie Madoff before Bernie Madoff. So, you know, Forbes magazine, for instance, will not, they say he's not a billionaire because they can't actually confirm that he has any money. It's that hidden. So very interesting. And I suspect he's not as rich as we're meant to believe. I think that is a smokescreen that Epstein creates, because again, I mean, look at the Palm Beach Police Department, video footage from when they, went through Epstein's house. You know, when they went to raid it and they were collecting evidence, that's available online. You can view it. It's kind of disturbing at times, but you look at that house. It's pretty crappy looking. very kind of cheap and gaudy. The rooms look like cheap motels. I don't know quite how much money he really makes. That's what I'll say. And I don't know how rich he is, but I think he's got enough dirt on virtually everybody, you know, in the sort of power elite that he's able to do whatever he wants.
Well, it brings me to an interesting thread because it's like when you look at someone like Donald Trump, if you talk to people in, at least the people I've talked to in New York, Donald Trump may be someone that hangs around the elite. And he is within that class that has money, but he has a lot of feuds with fellow elites like the Durst family, because he's not considered cultured enough. I mean, would Epstein be in that camp as well? Someone who's seen as like the lowbrow end of the elites?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. I that's a tough one to kind of nail down. I mean, he absolutely came from a poor family. And I think that is, again, if I was to try to break down Epstein psychologically, I think that is a huge factor in his own life.
It's a Jordan Belfort type thing all over again. Wolf of Wall Street, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, he grew up, I mean, his parents were, you know, I think his mother, Paula, her parents were from Lithuania, and I believe they moved to America, I think during World War II, and his father, Seymour, is his parents emigrated from Russia, you know, and they he grew up out in Coney Island, you know, in a working class poor neighborhood, you know, nothing that would immediately kind of you know, he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth, you know, unlike Donald Trump, who's not cultured but was always rich, you know, his father. You know, and famously, his father was, you know, this sort of slumlord in, like, Queens, and I think Brooklyn as well, but I know Queens was his big one. And he supposedly kind of warned Don from moving into Manhattan. He said that's not really our scene, you know. But, you know, he was rich, whereas Epstein, he lived out in Seagate, in, you know, not a fancy place. You know, he then went to Cooper Union briefly. Then he went to NYU briefly. He never graduates from any of these colleges or universities. And somehow he gets a teaching job when he's 20 years old at Dalton, which is a very elite private school on the Upper East Side with no teaching degree, no anything. And it's through that, through Dalton, that he ends up tutoring son of Alan Ace Greenberg, and it's through that he eventually gets a job at Bear Stearns. I will note that there's some differences there. You know, some accounts state that he started dating the daughter of Ace Greenberg, and that's how he got the job. But either way, he somehow ends up at Bear Stearns. And until he has to resign under very suspicious trades, insider trading and stuff like that. But yeah, he never he other people have, you know, that have talked about Epstein, you know, always remarked that, you know, he not that he had a chip on his shoulder, but that he was always sort of trying to he was always trying to kind of climb that social ladder, both financially and in terms of influence and stuff. Now, I think in his own mind, he certainly sees himself as very sort of grandiose. But he's not really from that world. Although, for a variety of reasons, everyone in that world, you know, that is really truly from money or from power or whatever, they all kind of gravitate to Epstein. Now, you know, so that says a lot about his own influence and his own aura. But yeah, he's not from that world. Although I think that is partly probably why him and Donald Trump get along to an extent, you know, is that they, even though Trump was born rich, you know, he always had that kind of chip on his shoulder about not being cultured enough, not being taken seriously. And they both have pretty gaudy taste as well.
Yeah, it's always fascinating to people, to me, when people talk about the elites, they think of like people that are always trying to be as grandiose as possible. And really, I mean, at least with like European elites, from people I've talked to who've sort of met those people in that strata, it's not necessarily like that. A lot of them have wealth that is, you know, basically handed down to them. A lot of their clothing and a lot of their like furniture and stuff, they don't necessarily try to be as extravagant. Like, I feel like people like Epstein and Trump almost are overcompensating in a way.
Oh, well, that's a thing that many people have remarked on who knew Epstein or know Epstein. And this is sort of I kind of agree with this sort of theory. The only reason Epstein got caught was because he flaunted his influence and wealth to such a degree that suddenly this man was not on anyone's radar beyond – I would say the true elite within New York. Okay, so the real kind of movers and shakers within New York, both in the world of business and politics, they knew who Epstein was. But even so, he was sort of this like mysterious figure. Now, it wasn't until he flies Bill Clinton, Chris Tucker, and Kevin Spacey to this AIDS conference in Africa that suddenly then he was on everyone's radar.
On the Lolita Express.
Right, which is this other, right, exactly, which is another, I know Ed has talked about that term and I totally agree with Ed. Anytime someone says Lolita Express, they don't know really what they're talking about. I think that's, again, is just a way of, like Ed says, of making it sound like this was all happening up in the air, you know? Whereas, I think that most of this abuse was actually happening in Palm Beach, New York City, down in the Virgin Islands, and in a place where nobody ever talks about, in New Mexico, at his ranch in New Mexico. That was what sort of put Epstein on the map. And then suddenly you had people like Vicky Ward, who at the time was writing for Vanity Fair, Grayson Carter, the longtime editor of Vanity Fair, asked her to do a piece on him. And that is the first sort of big piece that was ever done. And Vicky Ward has since spoken about the weird circumstances of these interviews that she was giving with Epstein. Also the fact that she had two young girls on the record with their parents that would confirm that Epstein had abused them. And that got spiked by Vanity Fair. And she couldn't get them to come forward. They were too afraid. But, from that point on, though, he began to get a larger and larger profile. There were more articles about him. Suddenly, then that was when you saw Epstein giving tons of money to Harvard. That was when he founded all sorts of strange foundations. One of them is, I think it's called like the V2 Foundation or something like that. He had a foundation down in the Virgin Islands that was supposed to be science-based for children. He started making himself known. And I think that he wanted to be a part of the glitterati, so to speak. He was suddenly it was a big deal. If Epstein went out to Harvard, all the professors wanted to meet with him. There's a famous picture of him and David Gergen, who's chief of staff for every president and used to be a CNN commentator. This is around the same time that Alan Dershowitz is gushing about this man, that, Alan Dershowitz, he won't publish a book but until Epstein reads the manuscript. That's almost verbatim a quote. Wow. From him. Yeah. So, and Alan Dershowitz said, even if I become, it's something like, if I lost all my money and I was just sitting on the boardwalk eating hamburgers, that would be okay as long as Jeff was with me. Something like that.
I think the Attorney General of New York has also been like weird about Epstein because of the lack of transparency in regards to the Jeffrey Epstein Six Foundation.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't disclose information on the end of their charity.
Oh no. It's very difficult to find anything on a lot of these things because the websites don't exist. You can thankfully through the Wayback Machine, you can find a bunch of really interesting stuff from from Epstein's various foundations and things like that. Of course, there's nothing clear with any of the finances with Epstein's various foundations. I mean, there's also a whole other issue with Citibank. There's some irregularities between Citibank and a company that that Epstein was connected to called Financial Trust Company. They had an issue with Citibank, you know, there's more allegations that a lot of what Epstein is really doing is a Ponzi scheme. And that would make sense because his mentor, Steve Hoffenberg, was one of the biggest. He was Bernie Madoff before, Bernie Madoff. And he actually ended up spending 24 years in prison. And Epstein somehow avoided any jail time, whatsoever. And they were working together the whole time, bilking like little old ladies, out of their pension funds and stuff like that. And interestingly, Hoffenberg has made it his mission since getting out of prison to go after Jeffrey Epstein. And Hoffenberg, they owned a company together, or it was, I think it was actually originally Hoffenberg's company. The name is escaping me right now. I'll try and pull it up. But, you know, he believes that Epstein was, stealing money, and that he was the real kind of like bad guy within the whole Ponzi scheme. It wasn't really Hoffenberg. And to add another layer of weirdness to this, Hoffenberg has this giant super PAC that dumps tons of money for Donald Trump, his best friend. So, you know, make of that what you will.
Backing up, it seems like he's been involved in a lot of financial chicanery. You even said insider trading. What can you tell my listeners about that, if you can expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So when Epstein worked for Bear Stearns, he was sort of, I guess, like he was sort of on his way to being like a big, you know, trader partner at Bear Stearns. Everybody loved him. Ace Greenberg, as I mentioned before, thought he was just the bee's knees. He even defended him, after he got kicked out. There was a big SEC investigation into insider trading that I think was sort of like across the board with, it was like all sorts of different traders. And all of the Bear Stearns employees were questioned, including Epstein, who denied any wrongdoing. And then he resigned mysteriously. Now, this was a guy who was on his way to making tons and tons of money. He was seen as one of the sort of real movers and shakers within Bear Stearns. But then the SEC starts questioning him regarding insider trading, and Epstein just resigns. Now, he's always maintained that his resignation had nothing to do with the SEC investigation. And in testimony, he says that, he basically says that he was he did maybe give some money or a loan to a friend. But he didn't think that it was like illegal and or unethical. And he didn't know that by buying stock and giving it to the friend that this was a problem. But again, he maintains that he did nothing wrong. But a lot of his expenses also kind of came into question. And then at the end, in the end, Bear Stearns fined him $2,500. But again, who gives up a junior partnership over $2,500. That's it, you know? So very interesting. There are also rumors that, he left because he was having an affair with the secretary. I don't really buy that. And here's the weird kind of kicker is that at the end, he still received a $100,000 bonus from Bear Stearns. Now there is a rumor that this also had something to do with there was this huge one of Bear Stearns' biggest clients was the CEO of Seagram's, the beverage company, Edgar Brofman. And Brofman made a bid to take over St. Joe Mineral Corporation. This is like back in 1981. St. Joe refused, and he was offering this like tons, like $2 billion in cash or something like that. And St. Joe refused, saying that it was grossly inadequate. And that is partly what triggered this SEC investigation. And there's some people believe that there is something that Epstein might have been covering, covering up for whatever was going on between Bronfman, Bear Stearns, and St. Joe Mineral, and that sort of, you know, he kind of took the bullet. But again, he leaves Bear Stearns when he's about to become a junior partner within this firm, make tons of money, you know? And then at the end of, you know, they find him this little paltry amount, and then they give him a $100,000 bonus. So, you know, that to me feels like a, you know, a payoff. You know, you took a hit for us. Here's this money. So, and
didn't he?
No, go ahead.
I was going to say he also paid off a few of these girls after the sex trial, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely.
He seems to be very good at this.
Yeah. There's also some other weird stuff. What is it? With this Anna Obregon, who's a very wealthy Spanish model actress, and her father lost a huge amount of money from this company, Drysdale Securities Corporation. And they ended up defaulting on like $160 million, all these interest payments that were owed, treasury securities that it had borrowed, and they lost all this money. And for whatever reason, Anna Obregon in 1982 asked Epstein for help. And at the time, Epstein was going around New York and other places talking, you know, he had formed this company called International Assets Group, which was basically run out of his apartment. It didn't really exist. But Obregon gave Epstein power of attorney over any monies that he recovered. And Jeffrey Epstein joined assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York and the Securities and Commodities Task Force, okay, and a former federal prosecutor called Robert Gold that was looking into where this money had gone and the whole Drysdale Security Corporation. And it took them like 3 years, but he ended up finding Obregon's money in a Cayman Island bank. And he probably earned millions of dollars off of that. And that is like another sort of like the next sort of milestone in a lot of this stuff where, you know, then suddenly other people started coming to him looking to find money that they might have lost or, more importantly, I think, to hide money. Then he was involved in some other bad financial practices in the mid 80s. You know, and he owed a lot of money. Epstein was constantly being sued because of idiotic. That's the other thing. He really doesn't know finances all that well. Now, he is good at hiding money and finding hidden money, but he's kind of an idiot when it actually comes to like the market or investment deals. You know, he was constantly selling his much wealthier friends on all sorts of, you know, including this oil drilling deal that completely went belly up. You know, he lost tons and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then he gets connected with Steve Hoffenberg in 1987, Towers Financial Corporation. That is the group. They hire Epstein as a consultant, but he works sort of hand in glove with Hoffenberg. Jeffrey Epstein is, you know, famous during that time because he handled Hoffenberg's failed attempt to take over Pan Am, the airline company. And Hoffenberg also tried to buy the New York Post at one point, which is another similarity. You know, Epstein gives money to more kind of tabloid media, sort of like the New York Post. I mean, Epstein famously gave a lot of money to Radar Online when they were in financial trouble. And Radar has been is a very interesting piece in this puzzle in terms of the way that they cover the Epstein story. But very quickly, and then I'll leave it to you because this is a kind of an interesting part of all of this. Hoffenberg then spends, 19 years, federal prison, for a $460 million Ponzi scheme. Now, when Hoffenberg was asked, how did Jeffrey Epstein avoid jail? Hoffenberg simply said, ask Robert Gold. And Robert Gold This is the same Robert Gold, this former federal prosecutor who Epstein worked with many years, or not many, but about 5 or 6 years beforehand when he was getting money for Anna Obregon. So Robert Gold was part of this task force that was working in the Southern District for their financial crimes unit. And he worked very closely with Jeffrey Epstein. And there are other people that have kind of come forward suggesting that Gold kept the U.S. attorney away from Epstein until the statute of limitations ran out with this whole Ponzi scheme. So, again, this guy is – that's what I meant when I was talking about, you know, he was known within the sort of political and financial circles, the elite within New York and specifically New York City. But that is the sort of I would say the first sort of step in terms of Epstein solidifying his wealth and his power. And shortly after that, he begins getting closer and closer with richer and richer people until eventually Les Wexner, who is the head of, you know, owns Limited Two, and for he owns Victoria's Secret. He owned a big share of Abercrombie and Fitch at one point. He eventually gets extremely close with Wexner, and that is essentially how he really makes his money, is managing Les Wexner's money. And Les Wexner, of course, is famously gave Epstein that massive townhouse in on the Upper East Side, supposedly for a dollar. He gave it to him for a dollar. That's how he kind of becomes very rich. But there's interesting. There's this guy Robert Meister, who was he was vice chairman of an insurance brokerage and consulting firm called Aon, he was actually a friend and a client. Les Wexner was a friend and a client of Robert Meister. Now, supposedly the legend goes that Meister meets Epstein. They meet each other on a plane. And they just sort of start chatting. But that is one way of how he kind of gets in with a lot of these people. But Meister's wife, Wendy, never trusted Epstein and called him the virus because he basically, you know, he kept showing up and he kept latching on to more and more rich people and started borrowing a lot of money from his friends to keep up appearances. But she thought he was a con artist, basically. So anyway, I'll leave it there because I know that's a lot of information.
Well, I was just thinking of there is this case a few years back with this guy. I'm forgetting what his real name was, but he pretended to be like a famous Rockefeller. He called himself Clark Rockefeller. And of course, that's a huge grift. And we see a return of this word grifter a lot in popular culture today. And it seems like Epstein is the quintessential grifter.
Yeah.
He's conning people out of money, basically.
Oh, yeah.
But it's who you know, not what you know, is the old saying.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
No, that's what the more and more I look into this guy, yeah, it's his whole life is a lie. You know, everything is a con with him. I think he grifted a lot of people out of money. You know, he is also, he seems to, like, dump people, too, you know? It's like once they're no longer of use to him, you know, especially when you go back in the 80s. Now, this is before we know of any, abuse. Now, I'm sure he was abusing kids back then as well. You know, I don't think that he just suddenly decided one day that he was going to start sleeping with 15-year-old girls. But all the same, you know, in the 80s, all this financial stuff. I mean, yeah, he would dump people all the time. You know, once he had used them up or they were no longer useful to him. You know, as I said, Robert Meister's wife, you know, calling him the virus, that, you know, every time like anytime like a richer person would show up, you know, like if they were having a party at the richest guy in the room, Epstein would latch onto them. And then if they weren't of any use to him, he would move on to the next person. But yeah, he's like the ultimate grifter. I mean, he somehow, he conned his way into being a member of the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations. You know, I mean, again, this is a man who really hasn't accomplished much of anything. Like I said, you know, he took some advanced math classes at Cooper Union, and then drops out. He goes to NYU, where he studies the mathematical physiology of the heart, but he never graduates. You know, he doesn't get a math degree or anything. Then he works briefly at a private school for rich idiots, basically, you know, inbred, New York's elite. Then he leaves that, works at Bear Stearns. Then he resigns under this sort of cloud of something. And then he kind of moonlights as this guy that can help you find your money if you've lost it. While at the same time, I mean, he's able to convince Anna Obregon to give him power of attorney over any monies that he would eventually recover, which is wild. You know, I mean, we're talking about tons, millions upon millions of dollars. But he does that. And then again, works for Steve Hoffenberg, and then he goes to jail, and then somehow Epstein gets a get out of jail free card, and then all of a sudden Les Wexner, who's a billionaire, decides to let this, you know, grifter have total control over his own finances. And then, you know, and again, Wexner, similar to Alan Dershowitz, Wexner puts all this, you know, I can't make a decision without Jeffrey Epstein. You know, famously, you know, he asked Epstein's advice on, you know, getting married and stuff. You know, he was an and Wexner, who's this, like, you know, decrepit old fart, married this, like, 31-year-old, just gorgeous model. And Epstein kept trying to tell him to stop doing it, you know. But again, he sought out his advice. But yeah, it's very interesting. And again, too, all these other people, Dershowitz thinks that this guy it boggles my mind to think about, like, what are these guys actually talking about? You know, when the cameras are off, when they're not in the spotlight, is Jeffrey Epstein really this brilliant, eloquent speaker who's this amazing, intellectual? Like I said, when he would go up to Harvard and stuff, you know, because he donated millions of dollars to, I think it was a medical school up at Harvard. When he would go there, you'd see these pictures. It's like he's holding court. You know, everyone wants to listen to what this guy says. But I mean, does he actually have anything of interest? Or is, like, my belief, this is all a facade in order to facilitate his extremely perverse, dark sexual needs? And that this is really all the ultimate grift. Because really, when it comes down to it, he's nothing more than a two-bit pedophile who's probably not very interesting is a very inadequate person. But he fills his life with all these other things. But it's really just a way for him to get access to kids. That's what I would say.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope, despite the unsettling subject matter, you found the first part of my conversation with Pierce Redmond of Porkin's Policy Review and the Open Minds Foundation on the sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein to be, at the very least, informative. And moreover, I hope you'll stay tuned for part two, when we delve deeper into the other players involved in this, well, rather grotesque story. Until then, I've got a track to close out the show. It's Under Suspicion by Soul Glue. Check them out, folks.